Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Now out of a hiring freeze, the Social Security Administration is preparing to rebuild its workforce, and fast. For years, the agency has faced low staffing, even while signing up millions of new beneficiaries every year. Recently confirmed Commissioner Martin O'Malley has some recruitment ideas in mind to make it happen. He says it'll take a bigger budget in fiscal 2025. Here with the latest, Federal News Network's Drew Friedman. And so it sounds like O'Malley feels staffing is one of the top problems?
That's definitely right, Tom. O'Malley says that SSA staffing is currently at its lowest levels in 27 years. And as you mentioned, this is at the same time that they're serving more customers and have more beneficiaries of Social Security than they have in their entire history of the agency. As a result, O'Malley has said that customer service is worsening. There's longer wait times on phone lines because there's not enough employees to answer them. There's delays in receiving decisions on disability applications and appeals for those decisions. So it's almost like a perfect storm of challenges. And O'Malley said as well that that's largely due to continuing resolutions and hiring freezes over the years that have prevented the administration from being able to staff up as much as it possibly can. Of course, that also causes problems for employees who feel overworked. They have too much work to do and not enough people to do it. This is particularly true in teleservice centers where employees are answering phones.
Sure.
And O'Malley actually warned lawmakers on the House Ways and Means Committee just last week of this exact issue.
Not surprisingly, when somebody's been on hold for an hour, they come off that call hot. And we right now have an attrition rate of about 24% in our teleservice centers. They are short-staffed, they are understaffed, and they are overwhelmed. Man, they're my heroes, and we need to do better by them. They are overwhelmed, stressed out, but still, every day, they're trying to make it work.
Sounds like a tough problem. And what does the Social Security Administration's budget look like now? And what is the White House requesting for 2025?
For this fiscal year, for the rest of 2024, the spending agreement that Congress just reached gives SSA a budget of $14.2 billion for its administrative expenses. That is pretty much on par with what they had for 2023, just about $100 million more. O'Malley told lawmakers, you know, it is better than a cut, and cuts were something that was on the table. But now he's looking for a bigger budget for SSA to try to really staff up and address some of those longstanding staffing challenges. For 2025, the White House is requesting $15.4 billion for SSA's budget. So breaking that down a little bit, there's $269 million for field office staffing, $85 million for processing centers, $79 million for teleservice centers, and then a really big budget for DDS, or the Disability Determination Services, $2.8 billion. It's a lot of numbers, but essentially it's about a 9% overall increase between 2024 enacted versus what the administration is looking for in 2025.
And did O'Malley give specific numbers on who he'd like to hire and in which positions?
He didn't give specific hiring goals in terms of numbers, but he's looking for more staffing for a lot, basically all of the components of SSA. So whether that's more judges, more field office workers, more people to answer the phones. I think all of those areas are places where they're going to be looking for more staff.
We need to change our strategy as an agency. I think we target too much on college graduates and not enough on high school and community college graduates. And with proper training, that could really be an investment that holds for a long time. You know, we used to have a program at SSA called Stay in School Kids. And I met people in Kansas City and town halls, employee town halls across the country. They've now been with the agency 40 years, but they're like, I was a stay-in-school kid when they hired me 40 years ago out of high school. So we could hire them if there's the money for it.
Yeah, some smart thinking there, it sounds like. And what about the concerns of lawmakers? What's their reluctance here?
On the House Ways and Means Committee, you had some concerns about just the caseload from members of the committee and looking for ways to improve customer service in a more short-term fashion. But I think one issue that kept coming up was also IT modernization. And a lot of lawmakers, or at least a couple, said that that was another way to ultimately improve workforce performance and morale. Currently, O'Malley said that 90% of SSA's IT budget goes toward just maintaining their outdated systems or their legacy systems and not actually towards modernizing SSA's IT. So the budget request is looking for some money to build on that and to try to start modernizing it. And Representative Blake, a Republican from Utah, described what he saw as the benefit of IT modernization.
We improve people's work experience by investing in these technologies to make their job satisfaction go up. You get better productivity out of them, and we'll see better hiring come from this type of stuff. So I encourage you to push as much as possible on this.
Well, it sounds like they're going to push on it. The sad thing is that Social Security has very clear statistics on how many people are going to enroll. They know all of the vital statistics of the country, life expectancies. They have squadrons of actuaries who calculate these things. They know exactly what their workload is going to be, how many checks, so to speak, how many benefits transfers they'll have to make per week, how many people they'll go to, et cetera, et cetera. It seems like they just need a process of convincing people, here's what it takes to do each 10 million recipients that we have. We're going to be adding 15 million in the next 2 years. Therefore, we'll need this capacity minus 5% for modernization or something. But that doesn't seem to have gelled as a process there.
Right. No, there are a lot of challenges. And I think you bring up a good point, Tom. There is, you know, ways that Social Security is trying to reform or thinking about reform. And they're proposing some ways specifically to try to staff up or adjust the way that their workflow works. But I think what you're hearing from O'Malley and other officials at SSA is that it's going to need that budget to back it up. But they're looking to hire up in all these different components. They're trying to focus in specific areas like hiring veterans, using skills-based hiring, as O'Malley mentioned, hiring more interns in 2025. So there's a lot of different paths that they're trying to put out, or feelers they're trying to put out, to staff up and really address some of those really long-term issues there.
Yeah, and they've got the statistics to make their case, because they know exactly what their workload is going to be. And every 10 million recipients, we get this many phone calls. So maybe a little AI apply there. They'll have a better case to make to Congress. Federal News Network's Drew Friedman, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And check out her story at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah. Excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down, so I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have, because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And work alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.